Morning.
Good morning.
Hope everyone is doing well today. We began this year by going through a sermon series called The Beatitudes, in which we were looking at the eight statements that Jesus made at the very beginning of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. For the next couple of weeks, we're going to spend some time looking at what Jesus says next in this very same sermon. So if you have a Bible with you, you can open up to Matthew chapter 5. That's where we're going to be studying today, Matthew chapter 5. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one in the racks in front of you. If not, we'll put all the scriptures up on the screen for you. But while you're turning there, let me set the scene for what was going on when Jesus was preaching this Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5 begins like this. It says, "Seeing the crowds, Jesus went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth, and he taught them." Notice how Jesus opened his mouth and taught them the sermon part. And notice how Jesus began the sermon by going up onto the side of the mountain. That's the on the mount part. So why we call this Sermon on the Mount? Here you go. And if you look again, the reason that Jesus had to go up on a mountainside to teach all these people in the first place is because a huge crowd started to follow him around. And these crowds, they began to follow Jesus largely because of the miraculous healings that he was doing. If you back up to chapter 4, it says Jesus went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. And these healings that Jesus was doing, they're not just minor things. It goes on to say that Jesus' fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, all those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures, and paralytics, and he healed them. It's one thing to make the sniffles go away, but to make paralysis go away, that's a big deal. You might have heard that 2 weeks ago today, I broke my face on a ski slope in California, and you might be thinking, wow, it's a miracle how good he looks right now, right? This is what I looked like a week ago. After some surgery, some metal plates and screws were put in my face, Humpty Dumpty was put back together again. But all this took place in a hospital with a surgeon. When it comes to Jesus, with just a few words or the touch of his hand, he was making paralyzed people walk again. He was making blind people see. He was making sick people well. Can you even imagine that? Now, the skeptical side of us might find this hard to believe, that Jesus could do something like that. But if it was you, or somebody that you know personally who was healed like this by Jesus, we would all do the same exact thing. We would follow that guy anywhere he went. And that's exactly what people did. It says, great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis, from Jerusalem and Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. And with these great crowds came a great opportunity for Jesus to explain what he was all about and what he had come to do. And what Jesus had come to do was not just heal people. It says that while he was healing people, he was also proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. Everywhere that Jesus went, he was always talking about this kingdom of heaven. In fact, one of the very first things that he was talking about when he began his public ministry was this. It says, Jesus began to preach saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And when Jesus says this sort of thing, people start wondering, what does that even mean? The kingdom of heaven is at hand. What is the kingdom of heaven? So, Jesus tells them. He sees the crowd, he goes up on the mountain, he sits down, and he opened his mouth and he taught them. And what Jesus says next is his longest recorded public address. It takes up the next three whole chapters in the book of Matthew. If you have one of those Bibles where all the words of Jesus are in red, the next 109 verses are nothing but red. And people call this the Sermon on the Mount, and in it, Jesus explains what this kingdom that he is the king of is all about. Now, we spent 8 weeks looking at these first eight statements that Jesus made regarding the kingdom of heaven. And in these opening statements, Jesus made it perfectly clear that his kingdom is different. The kinds of things that are valued in Jesus' kingdom are not the same things that are valued in our world. Jesus says things like, blessed are the poor in spirit. He said, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek. And in the culture that Jesus lived in, much like ours, those kinds of characteristics, they're not expected. They're not even common, and a lot of times they're not even desirable. But in Jesus' kingdom, he says, those are the characteristics that are going to describe my followers. And the first part of the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, describes what the followers of Jesus look like. And now the next part, the very next thing that he says, is going to describe how Jesus' followers are to relate to the world around them. It's what we're going to look at today. So will you stand with me as we read the next section of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount? Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 13, Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." That is our passage for today. You may be seated. Now here Jesus uses two images to talk about how Christians, or those in Jesus' kingdom, ought to relate to the world around them. But before we look at these images, it might be important to point out that Jesus has already told us that following him is going to fundamentally change the way that we interact with the world around us and the way that the world around us is going to relate to us. In the very last Beatitude statement, Jesus said this, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account." You see what Jesus is saying here? He's saying that if we follow him, if we live our lives in a righteous way that is patterned after Jesus, then we shouldn't necessarily expect the world around us to pat us on the back and cheer us on. Instead, he says, we might expect things like persecution. We might expect that others might revile us or even utter all kinds of evil against us. You see that? Sounds like fun, right? Now notice, when Jesus is talking about all this negative stuff that will be directed towards his followers, he adds this qualifying phrase, "falsely on my account." And what this means is that if people are reviling you and saying bad things about you because in your real life you're actually kind of a jerk and you're doing jerky things all the time, Jesus says that's on you. That's you thing. If you're being harsh and unloving and self-centered and people don't like you for that, Jesus says that's on you. If you're living hypocritically and inconsistently and people call you out for that, Jesus says that's on you as well. That's not what he's talking about here. Sometimes the opposition in our life is the natural consequence of wrong action. But other times, as a result of following Jesus, people are going to criticize you and persecute you and revile you and speak falsely against you. And when it happens, it may completely catch you off guard. It may be completely unwarranted or untrue, and you may wonder, why is this happening to me? Until you remember that Jesus said, if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. So Jesus is telling us that one of the costs of following him is that some of the hate that's directed toward him is going to land on us. And if you're anything like me, I hate to be hated. I'm the firstborn, people-pleasing, try-hard type. I can be overly sensitive, and I'm prone to avoiding conflict at all costs. Anybody else like that? Now, some people aren't like that. Some people love conflict. Some people thrive on it. They seek it out. They even stir it up, because they love a good back and forth. So when Jesus says, if you follow me, some people are going to hate you, those people are like, whatever, no sweat off my back, bring it on. That is not me. When I hear that following Jesus means that some people in the world around me are going to persecute me and revile me and speak evil against me, my gut reaction to stuff like that is to either compromise or detach. Because that's kind of how I deal with opposition of any kind. I'm not the let me speak to your manager type of person. In fact, when my food at a restaurant comes out wrong, I am more likely to eat it, to secretly hate it, to overtip on it, and then never say a single word about it. And I'm not saying that's right or even healthy to be that way. I'm just saying that's the way that my personality is built. But if my gut reaction to an overcooked steak is to compromise, then when it comes to the parts of following Jesus that people around me don't like, am I going to compromise there too? Am I going to compromise on morals? Compromise on biblical convictions? Am I going to compromise on the Bible itself and just pick and choose what parts of the Bible I accept and follow based on how it polls around the people in my life? Now, compromising isn't the only thing that I do in the face of opposition. I also detach. And there's two ways you can do this. You can do it quietly, and you can do it defiantly. Quiet detachment looks like this. Once you hear that following Jesus is going to cause people to oppose you, then you decide, hey, I'm just going to quietly remove myself from any person or any situation where opposition might come up. You ever do this? You ever detach yourself from anything or anyone where you think there might be opposition or discomfort or criticism of any kind? And what happens when we do that is we end up only surrounding ourselves with people who think like us, who act like us, and who live like us. Because if no one disagrees with us, then no one will ever oppose us. That's detachment done quietly. You could also do it defiantly. This is for those of you who like to speak to the manager all the time. When opposition comes your way, rather than backing down, you look it square in the face and you fight fire with fire. Except your response to their hate oftentimes looks like hate in return. It lacks empathy and compassion. It's soaked in judgment and condescension. And you end up surrounded only by people who think like you and act like you and live like you, because those are the only people that can stand to be around you. You know anybody like that? That's detaching defiantly. But Jesus says, rather than reacting to the world by compromising or detachment, he says his followers need to relate to the world as salt and light. Those are the pictures that he uses to explain. And not salt and light in the way that you and I might experience in our world. Jesus said this in the first century to a bunch of first century people. So whatever salt and light were like in the first century life, that is what a Christian is supposed to be like in the world that we live in. So what does salt and light in the first century teach us about following Jesus? I think two things. Let me give them to you in advance. Followers of Jesus have a distinct purpose, and they've been placed in a unique position. That's what we're going to see today. Let's take a look at the first one. In verse 13, Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." Nowadays, salt might be something that we might consider to be insignificant, or we take it for granted because of how abundant it is for us to get our hands on. At my house, I have the same bucket of salt that I got from Sam's Club that I've been working on for like 6 years. And I'm not even like a quarter of the way through. I use it on the driveway sometimes. But it wasn't always like that. In Roman times, salt was such a valuable commodity that soldiers were often paid in salt instead of money. This monthly allowance that was given to soldiers in salt, it was called a salarium, which is where we get the word salary. If you ever heard the phrase that somebody is worth their salt, this is where it comes from. And the reason that people were okay being paid in salt instead of money was because of how valuable salt was as a resource in the first century. In the first century, salt was primarily used as a preservative. The only way that you could keep food from spoiling was to use salt on it. So people would take their fish, and they would take their meat, and they would thoroughly rub salt all throughout that piece of meat, and it would hold off the decay until they were ready to use it. So when Jesus says that you are the salt of the earth, this is the image that it would have conjured up, rubbing salt into food in order to preserve it from decay. A couple of weeks ago, here at the church, we noticed a strange odor coming from one of the storage areas. So when somebody went in to investigate, what they found was all of our large coolers had been stacked away nice and neat for the winter. But on closer inspection, one of the large coolers was filled with hot dogs. Cooked in the buns, individually wrapped in foil, just like you may have seen them at the community picnic in September. Can you imagine the smell of that rotting food when the cooler was open? Just talk to Pastor Dave, he was all over that one. That's the image that Jesus is using when he references salt. It's a preservative. It keeps perishable items from rotting and decaying and falling apart. And when Jesus says that you are the salt of the earth, he is saying that the world that we are living in is perishable. It's prone to falling apart. And just look around. We see this kind of thing happening all the time in the world around us. Stuff falling apart. Relationships fall apart. Families fall apart. Your reputation can fall apart. Your personal life can fall apart. In culture, common decency is falling apart. Just look at the way that we treat each other today in the name of politics. Name-calling, mudslinging, lying, seeking out the worst in people. When you turn on the news, it looks like stuff's falling apart, doesn't it? And oftentimes, when we come into contact with the stuff in life that's falling apart, our initial reaction is to move away from that stuff. Do you know what we did with those hot dogs? We saved them for next year, right? We took them straight to the dumpster and we threw the cooler away with it, because who wants to use a cooler that a moldy hot dog has been touching, right? In everyday life, when we come into contact with stuff that's falling apart, we react the same way. I don't want to get any of that on me. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to go near it. Whatever is stinking and rotting and falling apart in that person's life, I don't want it anywhere near mine. That's our reaction, and it's kind of a normal response. But when Jesus calls his followers the salt of the earth, he is saying that we don't have normal responses anymore. We now have a distinct purpose, and that purpose is not to preserve our lives from the world around us. Our purpose is to be a preservative in the world around us. There's a difference. Instead of, I don't want to get any of that world on me, Jesus says, no, you're the salt. You need to get in there and get some of you on it. See the difference in how Jesus commands his followers to relate to the world like salt? In the 3rd and 4th century, in the Roman world, the Roman Empire was devastated by a series of plagues. And while this was going on, people started to flee from the cities. Wealthy people, government officials, even the doctors, they all fled to the countryside, leaving all of the sick and the dying to fend for themselves. Talk about stuff falling apart, right? I'm sure they would have a hand sanitizer back then too. And what's the natural reaction when stuff in life is falling apart like this? You get out of there, right? You get away from it. And that's exactly what the Romans would do. But many of the Christians, the followers of Jesus, who took seriously his command to love their neighbor as themselves, they stayed behind. And they met the needs of the sick and the dying and the abandoned. Instead of getting out of there, the Christians went in. That's what salt does. And because of this, Christianity began to spread within the Roman Empire. So much so that Emperor Julian, in a desperate attempt to stop the spread of Christianity, he began to write to all the pagan priests and try to revitalize paganism within the Roman Empire. In one of the letters that he wrote to one of the pagan priests, he said this: when it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the pagan priests, the impious Galileans, the Christians, they supported both their own poor and ours as well, and all men see that our people lack aid from us. Even Emperor Julian recognized that what the Christians were doing was completely different from what everybody else was doing. When everything was falling apart and everybody else was getting out of there, the Christians were going in. Jesus says that's what it looks like to be the salt of the earth. When everything is falling apart and everybody else wants to get out, Christians go in. But when you go in to a world that's falling apart, You have to be different. You have to be distinct. Jesus goes on to say, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? In Jesus' day, you didn't just go to the store and buy a tub of salt. Instead, often common people would go to a salt marsh, and they would collect what they referred to as salt, which was a white powdery substance that had salt in it, but because there were no refineries, it also had a bunch of other impurities that were thrown in there as well. And when they would use it, the actual salt in the mixture was the most soluble part of the powder. So every time they would use it, every time it would be exposed to moisture, the salt would get used up. And it would leave all of the impurities behind. And this leftover salt that was full of impurities was no longer good for anything other than to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. It's what Jesus is literally talking about. Now, this leftover salt, it might look like salt. It might actually be called salt, but it had lost its saltiness, which means it didn't have the power of salt any longer. If you would rub that stuff on fish, it would have no impact whatsoever. In the same way, when it comes to following Jesus, what might look like a Christian, what might even be called a Christian, won't have the power and the influence of Christ in the world if it has lost its Christ-likeness. One author calls Jesus' Sermon on the Mount the Christian counterculture, because in these 109 verses, Jesus lays out what salt looks like. In the next couple of chapters, Jesus is going to say some really countercultural things about lust and sex, about anger and revenge, about marriage and divorce, about loving your enemies and giving to the poor. And all of the stuff he says, it's very different. It's very distinct from the world around us. It's so countercultural that when you hear it, you almost don't want to hear it. But as Martin Lloyd-Jones puts it, the glory of the gospel is that when the church is absolutely different from the world, she invariably attracts it. It is then that the world is made to listen to her message, though it may hate it at first. Which leads us to the next part. Not only do Christians have a distinct purpose, they also have a unique position. In verse 14, Jesus brings in another image when he says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." Now, light is another one of those things that would be understood differently to the people in Jesus' crowd than it might be for us. At my house, when I come home and it's dark, all I have to do is say, "Alexa, lights." And in my house, you can see in the middle of the night everything as if it were the middle of the day. In fact, I have my Alexa set up with motion detectors. So when I get up in the middle of the night, everywhere I go, the lights turn on with me. I doubt anybody in Jesus' audience had it like that. But recently I learned that my familiarity with the lights in my house has left me ill-prepared for the darkness. Just a couple weeks ago, I was staying at a hotel room. And when I sleep, I need the room to be completely dark, like no lights whatsoever. So on the first night in the hotel, when I turned the main lights off, all of these little lights started to appear, like the glowing eyes of night creatures or something. First, it was the numbers, the glowing numbers on the alarm clock. Then it was the glow of the thermostat on the wall. And then there was a power indicator on the front of the television and a nightlight it plugged in the outlet by the bathroom. So I go around the room and I put a shirt over the alarm clock. I hang a sock over the thermostat. I take my room key card and I lean it up against the power light on the TV. And then I unplug the nightlight and voila, darkness. Right? Now I can go to sleep. Anyone else want to talk about it? Am I the only neurotic one? Now back in my house, when I get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom or get a drink, I am familiar with where everything in my house is because I put it there. And my girl Alexa lights up everywhere I go. But when I got up in the middle of the night at the hotel room, I was in an unfamiliar place in complete darkness. So I fumbled around the room, trying to feel my way to the bathroom. And just when I thought I was getting somewhere, I hit my toes against the leg of the desk chair. So, on the same trip where I broke my face, I also smashed my toe. And if you've ever done something like that, you know how much that hurts. So hopping around the room, I bumped into the wall, knocked the sock off the thermostat. I hit the TV stand and knocked over the key card. When I made it back to my bed and I got there, I pulled the shirt off the alarm clock to see what time it was. And then sitting there holding my foot, I noticed that with the light from the alarm clock and the light from the TV and the glow from the thermostat, there was just enough light to shine exact path from the bed to the bathroom. It was as if somebody planned that and purposely put all of those lights there so that I could be in the exact right position to navigate the darkness. Look at how Jesus says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." Notice the word set. It means positioned with purpose. So to put it in other words, you are the light of the world. A city positioned on a hill cannot be hidden. And the kind of city that Jesus is talking about here is one that in their day would be strategically built on the top of a hill so that it could be seen by all. And building a city like this was not just for its own recognition, but it served as a landmark or a guide to everyone around it. At night, the walls of the city would be lit with torches all around it. So even in the middle of the night, a traveler stumbling around in the darkness, like I was in the hotel room, could be guided by the light of the city that was strategically placed perfectly in the right position up on that hill. And when Jesus says, "You are the light of the world, a city set on a hill," Jesus is saying, in my kingdom, no one is insignificant. In my kingdom, you are a city on a hill. You are positioned strategically with a purpose for God. Now, that was a revolutionary thing for him to say because the people that he was saying it to included groups of people who weren't considered to have prominent positions in life. When Jesus says all this, he's talking to all kinds of different people in all kinds of different positions. He's talking to men and women. He's talking to rich people and poor people. He's talking to prominent people and inconspicuous people. He's talking to religious leaders and local fishermen. He's talking to tax collectors and people that might be behind on their taxes or something. And regardless of anyone's position in life, Jesus says that in my kingdom, you have been uniquely positioned by God. You are a city set on a hill. You see that? Now, what that means is that even though you might not consider your position in life to be significant, God says you've been set there for a reason. And it may not feel like there's a reason to you, but it didn't feel like there was a reason for the alarm clock to be so bright or the thermostat to be glowing all night until I needed them to guide me. In the same way, you never know how your current position in life is going to come into play in God's plan to impact the world. Maybe it's the people that you work with. Maybe it's the ones in your family, the classmates at your school, the neighbors down the street, the person who pours your coffee, or the one that cuts your hair. Maybe there comes a time in their lives where God stirs something up inside of them and they start searching for something that they can't really see and they don't even really understand what they're actually looking for. And then as they're stumbling around in the dark, they come past you. Is that going to be a help to them? Like the guiding lights of a city on a hill pointing them in the right direction? Or did you throw a t-shirt and a sock over it so you don't have to be disturbed? The way that Jesus asked it is, are you going to hide it under a bushel? Oh, no. You guys don't know the song? Hide it under a bushel?
No.
I'm going to let it shine. Here's where it comes from in verse 14. Jesus says, "Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to the whole house." If somebody lights a lamp and then covers it with a basket, not only does that seem to be a fire hazard, but everybody would see that and say, that defeats the purpose, right? Because the purpose of having a lamp is to light up the darkness. And if you cover it up, then it can't do what it was intended to do. And Jesus says that you are the light of the world. And God has put you in a unique position. So, are you going to let it shine? Or are you going to cover it up? Now, what does it look like to shine, you ask? Jesus says, in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. During those dark times in the Roman Empire, when everything was falling apart and everybody else was trying to get out of there, in response to the Christians who went in, the ancient historian Eusebius recorded this. It says that the Christians' deeds were on everyone's lips, and they glorified the God of the Christians. What if this could be said of us now? Looking around our world, it doesn't take very long to find something that's falling apart. What if we were the kind of people who went in instead of getting out? What would that look like? One sociologist of religion, Rodney Stark, he said this of Christianity's impact on the Roman world. He said, Christianity served as a revitalization movement that arose in response to the misery, to the chaos, to the fear, and the brutality of life in the Roman world. Christianity revitalized life by providing new ways to cope with the many problems in the world. To cities filled with the homeless and the impoverished, Christianity offered charity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachment. To cities torn by violence, Christianity offered a new basis for social peace. And to cities faced with epidemics, fires, and earthquakes, Christianity offered effective services. Seems like the kind of stuff that the Christians were up to in the Roman world when everything was falling apart there seems like a lot of the stuff that we could be doing here in the areas of our world that are falling apart, don't they? What if we could be the salt and light like this? How would that even start? Let me leave us with four questions based on what we've seen and heard this morning. First, how is your saltiness? If being salty is directly related to our living like Christ, then what areas of your personal life are salt, and what areas have lost their saltiness? Or to put it another way, what parts of your life do you need to give over to Christ? Second, are you rubbed in to the world around you? The purpose of salt is to be a preservative that is rubbed in so that things don't fall apart. Where are you currently trying to get out of? Where God might be calling you to go in. Now, it might be messy. It might be a broken situation. You might get some of it on you. But God has called us to be agents of change in the world that go in rather than go out. Third, are you aware of your position? Do you see the circumstances of your life as a random sequence of events or as a strategic position? If you are a city on a hill, like Jesus said, then all of a sudden, the happenings of your life don't just happen for you. Which leads to the last one. Is your light covered up? If God has set you in a unique place with a distinct purpose, then the light that we have been given is not just for us. Are we keeping it to ourselves? Will you stand with me as I pray for us? God, we thank you that you sent us Jesus, who is the light of the world. And because of what he has done in the world on our behalf, we too have now become carriers of that light. God, I pray that in response to you, as followers of you, as people part of your kingdom, that you would help us to resemble the salt and the light that Jesus described in the way that we react to the world around us. God, I pray that you would show us some of the areas in our life where we are losing our saltiness, where the way that we live and strive for righteousness might need to be more handed over to you. That you would make us something that we could not be on our own. That you would make us something distinct from the world around us. And God, I pray that the areas of our lives you would show us where we see the mess and we're trying to walk away from it. but you're calling us to go in and get involved for its sake, not ours. God, I pray that you would gently show us, that you would change us to be the kind of self-sacrificing people modeled after Jesus who are willing to walk into the broken parts of life so that they might bring darkness into light. God, I pray that you would show us the different parts of our lives that we might think to be common and mundane, routine and happenstance, and allow us to see those as strategic places for a specific purpose. God, I pray that we would be forever ready, that if there comes a day when you begin to stir the hearts of the people in our lives, when they come across us, we all would be tiny little lights that are helping help direct people in our lives to find you. God, we thank you for all of the lights that has led us to you. We pray that we too would be a light that help others find their infinite worth that you've given to them, and that the love that you have said about them when you gave Jesus to die on the cross for their salvation. We pray all of this in Jesus' name.